Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by GoToMeeting. You know, GoToMeeting is one of those great programs and softwares and those innovations in life that allows you to really, well, do lots of things more than just have to run back and forth to the office when you need something. You can work from anywhere. You can share things. You can actually, you know, have a meeting online and easily not spend all that time traveling. So think about all the time that you'll save. I mean, it's really quite amazing. And GoToMeeting is actually offering a free, that's capital F-R-E-E, free trial for anybody that is listening, and you can go to gotomeeting.com and enter the promo code podcast, and you get a free unlimited 30 days. So check it out now at gotomeeting.com with the promo code podcast. The debt ceiling talks stall. Markets dropped 3-4% for the week, and Spain is in line along with the U.S. for a downgrade. We have all this and lots more on this exciting episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 223, for the beginning of August 2011. Thanks for joining me. Andrew Horowitz here. And I know that you have been wondering what in the world is going on. It seems like we've seen some reasonable corporate profits, but yet at the same time, everywhere else around the world, the governments and the fighting and the commodity prices and the legislation has been just overwhelming. And there's no question of that. That's why we saw the VIX, the fear gauge, the options that track the sentiment, if you will, of option traders is up 45% for the week on fears that a debt ceiling and budget bill impasse is highly probable. In fact, there's a lot of irony going on right now. In the markets, we've seen, for example, on Friday, probably one of the most odd developments. You saw an incredible appetite, an insatiable appetite almost, for bonds. Now, you think about that for a second. The U.S. bonds are under attack in a way because there is concern that the U.S. is not going to have the fiscal wherewithal to actually pay their debt, right, in a default. Well, I'm not buying that. There's plenty of money to go around. Tax receipts are good. It's not like we have a liquidity problem right now. It's more that we have a legislative problem right now that's really causing these problems. The general disagreement between the two sides, or three sides, that is causing for a gridlock of epic proportions that is causing for a lot of concern. And then, of course, the various political bantering about the end of the world, the news picking up on every item saying the difficulty this is going to cause on August 2nd, giving these deadlines that Social Security payments won't be paid and there'll be lots of furloughs in the government and so on and so on. The biggest problem right now, in my opinion, is not the debt ceiling being raised. It is a long-term fiscal tragedy. It is a terrible thing to have this level of debt. I mean, just think of yourself personally. If you have this much credit card debt, you would be strangling on the payments unless your credit card company was kind enough to reduce those payments down to, I don't know, 1%, or how about 0 to 0.25. Now, that would be good. You can carry that for a long time, but one day is going to be a day of reckoning. In fact, if we look back to the housing and financial crumbling back in, let's call it 2008, 2007, where the housing started rolling over. But 2008, 2009, what really was the final nail in the coffin to all this? Yeah, it was the speculation in the housing, and it was the excessive spending and debt that was being carried. But more so, it was these adjustable arms and balloon payment deals that were put out there, allowing for people to finance their debt at ridiculously low levels, giving them the feeling that they were able to carry this for some time. Well, when all of a sudden, the person who had a $250,000 mortgage at, let's say, 2%, found their bill going from, on a 30-year mortgage, let's say, $2,500 a month to $4,000 a month because the rate went up to 7% after the adjustment period. And then they weren't able to refinance because their financial household, assuming they're still working, wasn't providing enough income in order to meet the criteria. And so what happened was that they weren't able to pay that a higher level. And in a sense, that's where a personal default came in, or a foreclosure on that property. Now, if you think about that, that single person, that family that had that problem, and now transfer that exact circumstance onto the U.S. or Spain or Portugal, wherever you want, and look at the relationship. So let's just go back to the beginning. We have an excessive amount of spending, and in this case, we talked about a house, done on an income that was only able to support a certain level, but then because of low interest rates and financial trickery, let's just get that out on the table, right? The arms and the balloons and all this were really not thought through very well, and the discussion of higher interest rates really never entered the picture. The thought was that they would just roll it over into another arm sometime in the future and just keep on doing this perpetually. The United States spends a lot of money on various things, but one of the things they obviously did over the last number of years was to bail out the banks, provide stimulus, and a host of other entitlement programs. Now, what that meant is that the spending over the last 18 months or so of about $100 billion a month, more than was usually spent in the form of the debt rising, about $1.9 trillion, and the excessive amount of money that was put into the system due to the bailout to the banks and all that, and the tax revenues that weren't making it up. And so the debt rises to a level. But good news, the Fed has provided, in a way, a low interest rate. So therefore, the issuance of debt and the ability to rack up more of a mortgage on the house of U.S. has been multiplied. And here's the thing. It may be out of the control of the U.S. and the Fed to keep rates down, because what happens if the rating gets cut? Right now, we're AAA rating in the U.S. with a negative watch on it, and there's been a lot of commentary by Moody's and S&P about, even if the debt ceiling is raised and this does come to an end, this whole bickering about how to save a couple of trillion dollars over the next 10 years, that may not be enough to sustain the credit rating. Now, if that does happen and the credit agencies decide to pull the rug and do something that nobody's done and downgrade the debt rating by, let's say, a notch of the U.S., and we go down to a AA or so, that could mean at least a 1% rise in the cost of our debt. In other words, the issuance of new debt, because of what, whether it's institutions and hedge funds other than sovereign nations, they will not pay receive an income that is less than a certain amount on less than a AAA bond. There's other things that we'll get into in a second, some of the ramifications. But basically what we're going to see is that interest rates will rise without any way for anyone really to combat that. Now, what was really interesting is, and we're going to get back to that in a second, but what was really interesting on Friday, this past Friday, was that there was a lot of bond buying on the long side going on. Now, the GDP number came in at 1.3%, lower than expectations of 1.8%. There was also a gigantic, more than gigantic, an enormous amount of revisions to the past. If you saw the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, they talked about how in the past couple of years that GDP has been overstated by about $300 to $400 billion. And in some cases, in some quarters, GDP was overstated by a full percentage point. Last quarter went from a 1.3, I believe it was, a 1.4 to a 0.4. So that growth that we thought we were having, while it was slowing a lot further than anticipated. Now, of course, this quarter we have 1.3. It hasn't been revised yet because it just came out. But assuming it is 1.3, that is still extremely substandard compared to where we've been and to where we should be right now. In other words, in most recessionary environments, when you do have the growth phase after a recession, you see a comparison to the recession levels. Let's say it's a negative 5, negative 7 GDP print. And you look at a year-over-year basis and you see that because of growth normalization, just normalization, you get a dramatic pop, sometimes a V-shape, in the recovery. Well, that didn't happen. We should have seen 7, 6% GDP growth probably 2 quarters ago, maybe 3 quarters ago. We only saw about 3 and change, and then that was revised down. So the idea that we have a structural problem, but now they're calling it a there's a new word they started to bring up, and it's a growth recession, which means that the growth, I don't know what this is getting on the, bordering on the silly, by the way, but this is means in the eyes of economists that growth is unable to keep up with the pace of required employment. And that's why we have such a high level of unemployment. I think they could take that and throw it away because they're just trying to come up with some kind of tags to make it all seem much more confusing than it is. It's very simple. We don't have the growth. We don't have the jobs. We're not going to have the jobs due to offshoring, technology, and the fact that there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty due to the legislative environment. And we're going to get into that at the end of this discussion, because I want to talk about some of the risks we have that maybe you haven't thought about. Good and bad, both sides. You know, risk of uncertainty, et cetera. But we'll get into that. Some of the things you know about, but these are kind of the tweaking items that we want to look at when it comes to risk. And I think the summertime, in the doldrums of the summer, a lot of people are on vacation. It's a good time to step back and just reflect on some of the things that we want to do and some of the rules that we want to live by. And if you're frustrated or even thrilled with the current market conditions, just step back and revisit some of your core principles. And we'll talk about that. Now, while we have this quick moment, I'll mention that we have next week Scott O'Neill coming on, because I talked to him last week. He has they put out an amazing application for the iPhone and the iPad. I like it for the iPad better because it's bigger, but it's the Market Smith for iPad. I want to talk to him about that, plus some of the recent calls by IBD and market items. He was pretty bearish last time we had him on, if you remember, and he wasn't wrong. I think the time before that he was equally bearish, and I don't think he was wrong either then. But I want to talk to him about that, and we'll also have Kevin Hoffman. We're going to talk about screens, how to create screens, or maybe some ideas on how to find stocks. I think one of the hardest things that a lot of people face is, well, how do I find that stock? Yeah, I could see the next day when something went up, but how do I spot stocks before they run and maybe some great stocks that I never heard about? Because we all know the Amazons, the Apples, Baidu's, Google's. We all know the ExxonMobil and Ford. We all know those names. But what about some other names that you may not know about, like Gulfport Energy or Zag, or possibly even, were you able to catch Fossil? So we'll talk about that with Kevin Hoffman next week. But here's a couple of things I want to talk about. There's a lot of questions that came in. We're going to talk today about my setup of my systems. I've gotten a lot of questions about that. What does it look like in my office? Now, just we're talking about my personal office. What am I watching? How am I set up? What is my computer like? So we'll talk about that. I'm also going to talk about the idea that, again, getting back to some basics, and talking about what's going on there in a moment. But let's just continue on with the markets for a second and talk about how now we are faced with the possibility of an increasing rate on interest rates on bonds, and that the bond investors, again, just kind of weaving in and out here a little bit, I'm sorry about that, but that the bond investors want to buy bonds all of a sudden. What was that about? Well, if you think about it, with the GDP print coming in pretty low, as we mentioned, and I'm not going to say a recession on the horizon, but at least slow growth or slowing growth, where do investors want to be? Do they want to be in stocks when a good chunk of companies are saying that they're seeing a little bit of a slowing? Maybe, depending on the stock. Do they want to be in the market as a whole, just a big broad brush index? Maybe not. That's why we're seeing billions of dollars coming out of equity mutual funds week after week. I think we're on the 12th or 15th week of outflows in equity funds. But again, on specific equity funds, they want to be in European. Not really. They want to be in gold. Yeah, bingo. That's one. Silver, maybe. Some commodities, possibly. But you know, when all else fails, they want to come back to being in the U.S. bonds, in particular the longer-term ones, because if there is a quote-unquote default or if there is a missed payment, it's going to be on the shorter-term bonds, the ones that are due now. So you go out and you buy the longer-term bonds. The 30-year was up 2% on Friday. TLT, you can look at that. That was up about 2%. That's amazing. Given the fact that there was no vote that was passing through on Friday, and given the fact that there is a slowdown in the U.S., I guess the question was that this was a clear safety trade moving right into bonds and pushed bond prices much higher and yields much lower. Again, good for the payment plan for the United States, but that's not sustainable. Bond prices will be bid up the longer you have an environment that is a slow growth environment. Now then, when you look further at why that was and why the safety trade came about, even though there was some kind of convoluted discussion and plan by the Eurozone a week ago and markets cheered it for about a day and a half, the reality is that the contagion factor keeps on growing. Now, we dropped down for our global allocations about a month and a half ago a lot of our positions in the international area because we were concerned about not only the euro but the zone entirely, because we saw that the rates that were being paid by Italy and by Greece, by Ireland, Portugal, were really starting to get a little out of control. CDS, or the insurance factor, the insurance devices that are used oftentimes by institutions to protect their investments or to bet on a failure of one of these sovereign nations, were really just kicking up pretty hard. And on top of that, we just couldn't get a handle around the growth potential for Europe as a whole. There's certain areas that are better than others, like Germany, for example, France maybe. But now we saw the downgrade, or at least the talk about a downgrade of Spain. Now, let me put this into perspective for you. Greece, it's kind of like what would happen and the problems if Rhode Island would default or have financial problems. Italy, we can go so far as saying that maybe it's something like, I don't know, maybe could be North or South Carolina. Spain would be California and Texas, possibly even New York combined, in terms of the gravity of the amount of money we're talking about compared to the Eurozone and what would have to be the slack that would have to be picked up by the ECB. Now, the ECB, admittedly, by them, does not have the money to backstop Spain. They just don't. And we're talking about enormous sums of money. If you think about that, Greece, little country Greece, what have they done? They've done probably close to $400 billion at this point. Last one was 250, and they got a couple of hundreds, I think. So I'm close to a half a trillion, 500 billion. We're not talking about a little bit amount of money here. We're talking about some serious scratch. Now, you kind of compound that to the, and do an adjustment of that to think about, wow, what would it be for Spain? We're talking about enormous sums of money that is just way too much for them to bear. And now that Moody's is talking about a downgrade and looking at the banking sector there, because Spain's banks overall have had the worst overall rating in terms of when you look at the possibly flawed, but let's take it at face value, the stress test that were recently put on the banks. The most concentration of banks in any country that failed were Spain, with a 25% unemployment rate in the country and a property bubble that burst like none other. We're talking about serious problems. So now you combine that with slow growth, combine that with Japan's exports dropping, combine that with China staying on the tightening trend and saying that their banks do not have enough capital and the reserves are not adequate to cover the losses that they anticipate happening. Just talk to Jim Chanos about that, or we had Vitaly on. We talked about that. You know, these are kind of the areas that are spooking investors. We're not even talking about anything going on in the Middle East anymore. We're really focusing on just a few select areas, and there's a big concern. Don't forget, what the U.S. does, for the most part, the world does. And the U.S. is not immune to the European disaster because we are feeling a bit of its brunt. The good news is that for whatever reason, that the dollar is still so severely undervalued and moving lower, it seems, that it is really good for our exporters and for our companies in this country who do business outside of the borders. It's fantastic. Really, you couldn't get any better. Now, it does weigh on other countries, and we saw that with Japan. Japan's, the yen, amazingly, is at the highest point in, I think, ever. Forget about that one day down after the earthquake and that movement. Aside from that, the yen is probably at the highest point it's ever been. Think about that. 20 or so years ago, it was at about 300. In other words, you could buy 300 yen per dollar. Now you can get 77. Think about how much more profitable those companies in Japan would be if, in fact, we saw a better priced yen. Think about that. Do you imagine how much less we'd actually pay for a Japanese car? And you wonder why, even though this currency is high too, but Hyundai, Korean, their profits are just off the charts. First thing is that they didn't have any part manufacturing or any kind of supply from Japan. Well, that helped them because they didn't have any disruptions after the earthquake to speak of. Their cars were stocked in the lots, and people were buying those, and there was no concern about those, and they were getting all the overflow. Amazing. Plus, they could have a little bit more wiggle room when it comes to the currency exchange. Not much, but more. So these are the things that are really haunting the market right now. What's going to happen? Here's a prediction. Next week, we have a lot of data coming out again on the economics, and everything right now generally has been pointing to a worsening economic picture, the backdrop. Manufacturing looks pretty awful. Consumer confidence is pathetic. The Michigan Sentiment Survey came out last week and was the lowest since March of 2009. Expectations were horrible. It's a three-component series we have current, but the expectation is the one that we want to look at because we want to see what are people thinking about the future. Because when people think about the future, they think about what they're going to spend on, what they're going to do, their opportunities, and it creates, it's somewhat self-fulfilling, but it also creates what their mindset is for how they're going to act. With all of this confusion and markets, and people hate confusion, with the debt ceiling, the uncertainty about legislation, this is some of the things that are going into this confidence number. But next week, we have some more manufacturing numbers coming out, which are very important. That's on Monday. And then on Wednesday and Friday, and throughout the week, Thursday too, we have initial claims. We have claims numbers and jobless numbers coming out. In other words, what is going to be the unemployment rate? Right now, it's 9.2%. And we're wondering, are we on the way to 9.5, that was just a blip when it went down a little bit? Or are we kind of, or is this a blip and we're going to, you know, in the eights? Fact is, no matter how you want to look at it, we continue to have a miserable job situation. And it's compounded by the fact that the labor participation rate, in other words, the amount of people that are actually working, are less and less, which helps to create a skew towards a better unemployment rate. Without figuring out all the math behind this, just trust me for a second here, that when you look at the less and less amount of people working, what you're really taking out of that is the people that are still looking for jobs that are not working. When you extract that from the data set, there's more people working overall. Does that make sense? So with the unemployment rate, you always want to look at the labor participation rate. And you can find that on briefing.com. You can find that on EconoDay, BEA. There's a variety of places. Just look at what that trend is doing as well. I've seen some numbers that shows that we've lost close to 10 million jobs in the last 15 years or so. That's a heck of a lot of people not working. If you look at the comparative between I think it was the 80s, late or the early 90s. So when you look at this, we're going to have a lot of volatility. And again, we're going to get in a moment to all the different risk factors that you need to be aware of. But you have headline risk factors. You have next week the debt ceiling issue coming to a head. You have jobs numbers coming out. And to be honest with you, there's going to be some violent moves in every direction. You're very close to the 200-day moving average of indices. You've broken through the 50 already on the S&P, the Russell, the Dow. Russell's resting right above the 200. The S&P bounced a little bit off of that. And this is usually a point where an index will find support or break down hard. Now, there's been some discussion about technical analysis saying that if it does break from this point, we're going down to about 1130. That's about a 15% dip from here or so. Maybe 18%. Pretty serious stuff. What's going to prevent that? That's a big question, right? Well, some of the things that are going to prevent that, if we can see an end to all of the exceptional amount of bickering in Washington, okay, that's fine. Get rid of some of that. A cooling off of the European situation and some better economic numbers, because we're coming to a point where earnings season is going to be behind us. And the tailwind we have usually during an earnings season when we have better earnings moving into the next season, and there's a pretty substantial break between where markets can just move all over the place. And if we don't see anything to counter the negative economics, so in other words, you have a bad jobs number, you know, you see bad manufacturing numbers that are dropping, and you know, you look at all these different numbers, and but yet you see earnings that are looking pretty good and revenues numbers that are growing, you know what? People can dismiss that. They can say, you know what? We still have a good earnings environment, and that's okay. We can live with the economics being questionable and up to a certain point. But if the economics don't really impact the companies, well, the stock market can do okay. It's when both converge in the same direction that we really have problems. I've made the case before that actually, and this is a pretty unpopular idea, but that if you have a job situation temporarily that is decaying, eroding, and we're seeing a higher unemployment rate, we're seeing more people laid off, that could actually be good for stocks, certain stocks. So Cisco, a miserable, miserable chart. But they're laying off 10,000 people. Merck, 2,000, 3,000 people. Companies across the world are really trying to trim down once again. It's almost another trimming that's going on right now in the world, like we had a few years ago. And in fact, that really does wonders for the bottom line. The question is whether or not the company can stay profitable and do the business that they're supposed to, provide the service, and maintain their leadership with a much leaner staff. But assuming they can, what you'll have is a tremendous amount of benefit to the bottom line. Maybe not immediately, because there could be some payoff requirements for retirement, pension, etc. But over the long haul, what you'll find is you'll have a really nice bottom line boost. And then you set the stage for a company being much leaner and meaner. The question always remains when and if they'll hire back. In the meantime, what they'll have is, again, some benefit and a quick fix. But we'll see how that plays out. But I will tell you that I can't imagine, when we look back on this, that the unemployment rate is going to get any better, in a big way at least, for a while, as we're seeing more and more people being laid off. More companies announcing big cuts, and you see that in the various reports that we've been looking at. All right, well, enough of that misery. Here's the point, though. The point is that you need to be very careful. It's a stock picker's market right now. You have to be careful to rotate into stocks that are showing extreme performance benefits that maybe are oversold and can really benefit from maybe a slowdown. Stocks that will be a safe haven investments, sort of like the utilities and staples. Those have been doing well. Plus, be very picky and find those stocks that are leading. But remember something, that even in a market environment where you find a leading stock that's good, but that market environment is negative, likelihood is that people will be taking profits. So just be aware of that. Utilize some really good, we'll call it money management process, where you take some money off the table if things move against you. Don't get overconfident right now. As we see this 200-day moving average being tested on the S&P 500, remember that there's a lot of stocks involved there. And if they take down that, a lot of ETFs will be pulled. You see futures getting pulled. And what happens is when those selling pressures mount, almost every stock moves down. So that's why we've had a lot of these big 80 and 90% move days. In other words, 80% or 90% of the stocks move in unison. And especially during the summer, when you have a lighter trading environment, some of the traders are off doing their thing and not trading as much because whether it's the environment or just the beautiful sunshine, you have a liquidity issue. All right, let's talk about the setup that I have here. I'm also going to talk about some of the apps that I use next week when we talked with Scott O'Neill. But you know, people ask, what do you use? What software? What setup? What does it look like? Let me give you a quick visual of my routine and what I do. This is my personal office. I'm not talking about staff. I'm talking about my personal office here. I have my own printer, first of all. I'm kind of spinning around. I'm looking around here. I have my own printer because what I like to do is make sure that I have things handy here. I don't have to get up and run around. I find that every second of the day is important, and you want to make sure you have your office set up in a very organized, as organized for you, and accessible manner. So I have my own printer here. I also, by the way, have a printer in the office that is not, this is not in my office, but that has a its own email address, one of these HP ePrint printers. So if I'm reading an article somewhere and I want to share it, I can actually just email to that printer and it prints out from anywhere that I am. That's very handy to have. So I have a HP OfficeJet Pro K550 printer in my office. I have a Mac, but let's talk about the trading and the daily investment software and hardware that I have. So here's my basic setup. I have a Windows-based computer that has a i7-2600 chip running in it. And it is attached to a Windows 7 64-bit Ultimate program. I have 8 gigs of RAM. And I also have 4 monitors. I have 4 ViewSonic 24-inch monitors, color monitors, side by side. And to run those, I have I have NVIDIA cards that are, I believe, the 9800 XTs, 1 gig of RAM on there. And each of those has 2 DVIs out. Now, some of you may be going, what is he talking about? This is just the computer that I'm using as my core computer. And by the way, I also have a backup. In the event that my computer goes down, I have one that's just sitting there at the ready in storage in a closet here. It's ready to rock. May need a little tweaking here and there. But basically, I have a lot of things on backup, which I'll mention in a second. And I can pretty much, you know, within a pretty short period of time, get up and running. I mean, there are a lot of other computers in the office, but I'm talking about something that's the way I want it to be. Because you know how comfortable you get with what's on your desktop and, you know, what's around you and how you work and your general workflow. It's very important that you don't have distractions, in my opinion. If you're trying to focus on, it's hard, by the way, it's hard enough to focus with all the distractions that are there anyway during the day in the markets. Not only from a trading standpoint, but just from an investing or maybe just in your day with your family or your mother calling or your kids calling or your wife, whatever it is, your husband saying, you know, come home for dinner. There's enough distractions in life. So why make your area that you're actually trying to focus? Now, this goes to everybody that's not even trading or investing. This goes, I think, to the basics of, you know, how do you deal with the daily grind of your life, you know? I'll go one step further that my desk is a gigantic U, a horseshoe, I'll say it is. But I actually took out a piece to make it a little bit so that the area inside of it, I mean, we're talking about, I think this is 12 feet of a U on one side and it bends around, then 12 feet the other way. And the reason for that is that I keep all the work that I'm working on the desk to the right. To my left, I keep the phone. I keep my keyboard, my mouse, and all that, and my screens that bend around to the right. Again, they work together because I've set the computer up that each screen is just a part of a four-screen monitor, if you will. So it's one gigantic monitor that I sweep my mouse across. And Windows makes it easy to set that up. And I think it's also important to have instruments that you work with to be the finest. I mean, some people just say, oh, well, I have a mouse and a keyboard. Well, that's, for me, that's not good enough. Call me a little nutty. But I have what I think the best mouse on the market is. I'm not making a recommendation for this per se, but it's the Logitech Performance MX. Fits the hand great. It has a lot of shortcuts on there. It moves around wirelessly. It has a little stand that charges. It's just a brilliant little mouse. I also, you say, well, a keyboard, what's the difference there? Well, personally, if you've ever used, let's say, the Mac keyboard to the standard Windows keyboard, there's a big difference. The Mac keyboard's a flat, easy to get around. I don't know about you. I get caught up when I have to push my fingers all the way down on those buttons, and they're just, I don't know, they're not stacked right on the Windows machine. So we have, actually, everybody in my office has a HP keyboard. It's the, let me see what we have here. This is the, okay, the HP Wireless Elite keyboard. And it is a flat black keyboard. You can buy it. It's pretty cheap these days. And you can buy it. It's a wireless keyboard. You can move it around anywhere you want to. So if you want to move a little right, a little left, take it on your lap. And it's flat keys. So it's really, I find it really easy to type with. But then one more thing is, you know, what do you have as a mouse pad? We like to have a very slick surface with the mouse pad. So I have these X track pads. This is kind of cool. They're this very slick and shiny surface that comes in all sorts of colors and things, but it comes with a little bit of a tube of wax that you can get with it. Every couple of months, what you do is you actually take a little dime-sized drop, you put it on the mouse pad, and you wipe it with a paper towel and kind of buff it up a little bit, and your mouse pretty much just slides right across it. Now, these are just little bitty things that make life a little easier. What I also do is I put some very important points that I need to remember in small print. I attach those to my monitor. So along the bottom, I may have, for example, some important numbers that I have to call all the time. Or they may be some stocks that are on a particular list that I'm watching. But I don't keep it very cluttered. I keep it pretty clean. I keep my desktop with maybe, I don't know, a dozen or 15 different icons on there. Every once in a while, I go through there and I get rid of the things I don't need. I have a folder. It's on our network, but you could do this on your computer. I have a folder that's called temp. We know that that folder, no matter what's in it, can be erased at any time. You never put anything in that folder that you have to possibly reference and need in the future, because at any time that can be erased and cleared out. But when I'm doing things throughout the day, for example, when I'm blogging and I find a chart that I want to utilize, or I'm researching something and I find an article, I may put it in there and then use it in a very short time to put up on the Disciplined Investor website or our private client website. That's where I kind of store all those things that I'm working on, not my desktop. It becomes a mess. Terrible mess. Now, so you know the basics of what I have. Now, I have a pretty, we built that computer here. We always build our computers because I like to test it out and kind of get burnt in before I start using it, or anybody does here. And of course, backups on there. I have a APC tower backup on that. And it is a wired internet. We don't use wireless when it comes to trading because of speed issues and concern about, you know, just having a problem there. So it's much better just to plug it in the wall and have it wired. Let me think if there's anything else here. Let me look. Yeah, pretty much the same. I have a decent sound system on it, but that's hardly used. Now, what do I do on a daily basis? What do I look at? Where am I going? Well, you know, we use the professional version of Bloomberg. That's a costly item. It's very expensive. It's not for the average person to use. I mean, it's pretty sophisticated in terms of, and difficult to use, I meant to say, really. Very difficult in terms of just getting data out. I mean, it's there. Charts are there. Everything's there, but it's a big learning curve. Probably the greatest data that I've ever seen in my life. Most accurate and timely. But aside from that, we also have TradeStation in the office if you want to keep track of stocks. Probably the best way to keep track of stocks. Their trading platform is also good if you want to use that. But in terms of keeping a list and doing screening and you know, tracking alerts, maybe doing some automated studies and automated trading, as well as doing back testing, and simply having a place to spread out what the markets are doing in real time, what stocks are doing, currencies, commodities, it's all there. A lot of built-in indicators, stochastics, MACDs, you know, RSIs, and you can build your own. So there's all sorts of things in there. That's TradeStation. It's pretty inexpensive, by the way. But just from a strict tracking, alerting, managing, probably the best thing I've ever seen. Then we use Briefing Trader. There's a variety of services that Briefing has. Briefing Trader gives you up-to-date information that's a little bit more than just the news. They do a little bit of an analysis. So they come out with what expectations were, maybe what markets will do. Here's the earnings. They're very quick on earnings and what the expectations are and probably where support points are. So when Baidu earnings came out a couple of, I guess, last week, they said, okay, here's the deal. Baidu expect to earn this. If they don't get that, here's your points. You want to look at this is the drop point where it could drop to if it does quickly do so. And here's where the top end is if it kind of pops up to that level. So you could think about shorting and going long in the after hours. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just telling you they have these kind of things. So the trader is also much costlier than the basic briefing. I think they have a free version. On the free version, you can get economics, some earnings, a little bit of delay, I think, on some of that, but a good taste of what they're doing. The trader is a lot more expensive or a bit more expensive, not terribly expensive compared to Bloomberg, but they have more market calls. So they tell you, okay, you know what, time to go short on gold for a trade, or you know, we're going to do a swing trade into the banking sector or this stock, or you know, 'cause it gives you a lot of trading clues, which is really neat. Check out the Wall Street Journal from time to time. Of course, that's interesting. But more importantly, when it comes to the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Reuters, etc., I go to FinViz. FinViz has a page called News. On the left-hand side of the news is all of the, we'll call it the mainstream newspapers that they track for business. And the headlines just keep on streaming in real time. It just kind of keeps streaming. And it makes it easy to just click on something and find out what it's talking about. Very easily, there's a day's worth of headlines from about 20 different providers that are just listed very nicely there. On the right side are blogs. For example, we show up there. The Big Picture, Barry Ritholtz, Fund My Mutual Fund. There's probably about 15 or 20 of the top blogs out there in terms of investing that show up on there. And you can track what goes on there. So it's on one side is the mainstream, one time is blogs. Now, they also have a lot of other things on that. They have a screener on FinViz that's terrific. Free, by the way, but terrific. They have some really interesting charting on there that's automated. Tells you about all sorts of trends. Tell you about the first page about what's happening in terms of biggest movers in the market. Oftentimes, those are some of the penny stocks, but gives you a, kind of an overview. Insider trading. And a lot of other things they have there, too. Market temperature and heat, market maps. Really neat stuff over at FinViz. Let's see, what am I up to? I'm sure there's no surprise, but maybe, I don't know. I use a couple different browsers. For example, I use Google Chrome. I use that for my briefing. I just leave that up because I like to have, when you open up a browser window, usually what happens is in Windows, it opens up the browser. You can open up a new tab, open a new window, but if you close it, the whole thing closes. So on and off, I'm kind of in and out of browser all throughout the day, and I want to keep something up, so I keep a separate, unique browser open, which works fine. I use Google Chrome. I leave it on my right-hand screen all the way to the right, my fourth screen, and I leave it full size for the news to flow in the Briefing Trader. Now, for charting, aside from maybe TradeStation and Bloomberg, we also use stockcharts.com. There's a free version, but it's so cheap. It's $19 maybe a month or something. It's not cheap, but it's pretty cheap. Is you can store all sorts of things in there and keep annotations and markup charts left and right and all sorts of great tools in there. And this is probably the best charting, very simple, by the way, charting site that I've seen, because it combines the ability to do things on your own and create charts, indicators, etc., but also to get a lot of use out of many of the tools that they have there. And if you haven't done so, I would really highly recommend you check out stockcharts.com. Now, we look at JP Morgan Research. Pretty much we get the end-of-day report, and we see what's going on. That's more for institutionals, so I don't know if you could probably get that. But again, I'm just trying to give you a flavor for all the things that we look at. There's also the fact that we use Firefox mainly. I mentioned Google Chrome, but we have Firefox as the main that we use. We could, because I get to synchronize all my bookmarks. There's all sorts of add-ons. It's just, I find it to be a better play. That's my opinion. Some people like Explorer or Safari or, Opera or whatever else you're using. Let's see. Econoday. I mentioned before, they're a They're an economy-based site from Bloomberg, and they give you all the great economics. Investors.com, I kind of scroll through there on a daily basis, read Investors Business Daily through my iPad on a daily basis in the mornings or late nights. They actually come out, 9 o'clock at night for the next day or maybe later. But, you know, it's early enough but late enough. Let's see. And then you also have Market Smith I use for not only charting but for some of the information they have on the fundamentals of a stock. That's over from IBD as well. But their data, I always like to check and see how the data differs, if at all, from, let's say, Bloomberg to make sure that everything is right. We found some differences. And then we contact the companies to understand what is the difference. And, sometimes one is wrong or the other one is wrong. They need to update their information. Or we find that maybe they're looking at it with a different metric. That's important to know because there's a lot of players out there that are looking at the same data. And you want to make sure what they're looking at is what you're looking at. So, and then, of course, I get a variety of different newsletters. I get the McClellan Daily. Tom McClellan sends that. It's a whole host of different newsletters and letters. You have to see what really floats your pickle, if you will, and find out what you really like. All right, I wanted to also talk about, again, it's the summer. It's kind of that time where we need to refresh a little bit, just very quickly, in 7 minutes or less here or so. Talk about what maybe you should be looking at in terms of the risk. Next week, we're going to really pick up on this quantifunded techno again. And we're going to talk about screens with Kevin. And I want to talk about some of the ideas about, you know, where to go from there, the fundamentals and all that. But I want to really talk about some of the risks that are things you need to be aware of and what's happening and maybe probably pretty frustrating. You know, listen, I talk to a lot of professionals and there's a lot of confusion out there. While you'll see the pundits on CNBC and Bloomberg TV and Fox talking about how they know that end of year we're going to see 1,400 or 1,200 or whatever they're going to see on the stock market, and they all seem to know what's going on. I got to tell you something. I talk to a lot of them. A lot of confusion out there. A lot of uncertainties. If we could draw a straight line, yes, we know where things are going. That earnings are getting better, or at least stabilizing, generally speaking. And if you look past the last several quarters, it's going on a trend that's higher. Now, you can't just do that. There's a lot of things that come into play. For example, these are the things you need to kind of be aware of. Aside from earnings, aside from just the economics, aside from all those things that go on, there's legislative risk that's out there right now. We saw on the latter part of the week that Medicare payments are going to be cut, and a lot of the HMO stocks, and in particular long-term care facility stocks, really got crushed. Because with the legislative actions that are going on and with the desire to slow down on spending a lot of the money, because that's what everybody wants, well, let's all realize that if that happens, somebody's going to have to pay one way or the other. So we saw this long-term care situation where there's going to be, I think, $350 billion cut out of a portion of this, and a lot of the stocks in that sector really got hurt. So you have a lot of things that are really dependent on the legislative actions right now. And that's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's a fact. We need to be aware of it. You know, if there was this discussion for some time that the Durbin bill would actually reduce down debit fees on debit transactions, in other words, the cost per transaction, and Visa and MasterCard and a variety of other companies really got held back by that. Well, then when they came back, the estimates were for, it was very low. And then it came back about, 10 or 15 cents higher when the final resolution was finished. Well, those stocks really jumped. Take a look at the chart of Visa, symbol V. You'll see what I mean. Look at that one day that it jumped recently. That was because of a change to legislation. So if you were short that stock because you thought maybe, well, economy is cooling and people aren't spending, you got the Durbin bill hanging over them and all these other things, you would have gotten hurt because legislative actions are not always logical. You can't really predict what they're going to do. Just look at what happened with oil recently. The strategic reserves were released for about a day and a half. Oil prices went down, and they went right back to 100 in a matter of 2 weeks. So legislative processes and actions are not always predictable. You have to know that, and it's a big risk. It's sovereign. Sovereign, you know, years ago we didn't have to worry about this whole discussion. There was things here and there, and there was things in China and Latin America and, you know, around the world there were issues, but, you know, there was really nothing that was at this level, especially when it comes to the developed nations. You have banks and bonds and stocks just doing the hokey pokey right now because there's a question about the likelihood of a sovereign default. And then the question is, what does that mean? Unfortunately, or maybe I should say fortunately, none of us really know what that means. We haven't really come across something like that. Is it going to be worse than a layman? And it seems logical that it could be if something major happened. Is it going to be less than a layman because everybody expects it at this point? I don't know. I got to be honest with you. I don't think anybody knows right now. Some players on one side saying that a default of the U.S. is not going to matter to anybody because it's already baked in. I question that. There's others say, you know what? We're going to see a catastrophe. The banking system will freeze. Money markets will no longer be able to invest in treasuries. There's going to be possibly money markets breaking the dollar. We're going to see that interest rates are going to rise dramatically. Gold goes to, I don't know, $14 trillion. Who knows? I mean, you know, the gold bugs, it's going to go up, up, up. I mean, it will, of course, because gold is another currency, silver, to a degree. And, you know, there's going to be a gigantic depression. I don't know which, and fortunately we don't know because there's nothing that we have a history of knowing about and a track to really understand this. But realize that it will, in fact, be more than nothing. I'll put it that way, okay? Then we have weather issues. You know, I mean, do you ever think about weather? We have hurricanes, right? What happens when a hurricane comes into the Gulf of Mexico? Well, oil prices, natural gas prices usually spike. But you have other things like earthquakes and all that. You know, we don't know what the extent of the particular weather pattern is going to do. So again, you know, we can't ignore these things, particularly in the summer. So realize that these are again, I'm just throwing these out there as something to chew on, just ideas. They don't necessarily have to be bad. They can be good. For example, you have a hurricane. Well, if you're long oil, you're possibly going to see a nice little rise. So you can use these risks to your advantage. You know, the sovereign bank situation, in theory, you know, that Spain is having all this trouble, and we just talked about all that. Well, maybe you kind of look to short the euro or go long the Swiss franc if you're a currency trader. Or maybe, again, get out of bonds and use it to your advantage to buy another asset class that may do better. For example, back to gold. Then we have liquidity. We have liquidity issues that we have to look at. You know, we have to look at the market action just recently to see that the liquidity has kind of dried up in terms of the action. So now when we look at the action, we look at the ranges of movement. There's a lot less players out there that are playing. It's the summer. A lot of Wall Street traders take off and go over to Fire Island and to the Southampton and to Montauk, and they hang out on the island. And what happens is that, you know, we have a lot less liquidity. You have the sell in May and go away adage, and a lot of people just kind of like lay low. A lot of people aren't selling because they see that the opportunity to make money has been great, so they're just kind of sitting on things. And you see a lot more volatility in that environment. So remember that. Then we have this news. Boy, oh boy, do we have news. We have a news-driven market that moves at every burp and hiccup of the news. So, for example, we saw a problem with Spain's sovereign debt, took down futures overnight last week on Thursday, I guess it was. And then we saw that there was a bad GDP number. We saw that was negative, negative. Then we saw a consumer sentiment number that was negative. But then we saw a Chicago manufacturing number that was okay, all right. That kind of like in about 10 o'clock just evened things off, didn't drop any further. Then there was some talk about the budget debate and the vote in the Senate having some, or in the House that later that day, and markets started rising up. As a matter of fact, went positive. And then they realized, oh, that's not going to happen. And there's concern about weekend holding risk. So the markets came back almost 1% from where they were to end the day. And that's just the major news. Then you have the interim little rumors and news items that pertain to individual stocks. For example, there's some rumor that Capital One may be buying E-Trade and they moved up after hours. You know, you have rumors of a drug situation, for example, with the biotech that would be approved or not approved, and we see how that moves. So the news-driven market right now is so much more exaggerated due to the level of what's going on, but also because of the liquidity. or lack thereof. And finally, we have, I think, personal emotions that are a big issue right now. You know, we're not so far away from the major catastrophe back in 2007, 8, and 9. And I think there's a lot of it's still raw in a lot of people's mind about what happened then and how quickly it all really just developed and how similar it is right now to then when we had the TARP votes failing and the markets fall 700 points and we have, you know, it being approved and the market rises 700 points and we have the Fed coming in and buying and then stopping. And I mean, just it goes on and on and on, you know, and the failure of Lehman and then the possible failure of this one and then the saving of Citi. And then I just, you know, so I think it's a bit similar right now, but not from banks and not focused on banks, but focused on countries. So I think that some of it is not here, so it's not as detrimental to our psyche, you know, what's happening in Europe maybe. But the things that are happening here, I think, and the reminiscence of what did happen and reminders of what happened, I think that's really very raw in most people's minds, and that is still something that they find that they need to stay away from and not be involved in. I can't argue with that. I had a discussion with a pretty smart guy yesterday, and we had this discussion about, you know, just generally what's going on in the world. And he said, why in the world would I do anything but stay on the sideline? I said to him, you know what? If that's what you want to do and that's your, you know, your plan right now, that's fine. He said, you know, that's the plan. And, you know, that's fine. There's still some opportunities, and I think that there's great opportunities out there. And you just have to be a little patient or at least find the right places to do it. But nonetheless, you know, a lot of people have that mindset that there is no reason to get involved here in a big way. And I would agree with that. You know, we don't have as much exposure by any means that we had a few weeks ago. You know, we've trailed back, put a hedge on. We took down some of our, as I mentioned, in our global portfolios, our international and some of our small caps. So, you know, that right now we're waiting for kind of another signal that, you know, there's a little bit more of an all clear because we're not even near that right now. Anyway, we'll wrap it up there. It's trying to be a little bit lighter during the summertime, but there's nothing light to really talk about, unfortunately. But next week we do have Scott O'Neill from Investors Business Daily and more so from Market Smith, and he's going to share with us his new iPad app. If you can, if you do have a Market Smith subscription, go over and get the application before we talk about it so we can kind of go through it and you'll know what we're talking about. If not, I think they have a two-week version for like $19. Go get the trial. Just go over to get the trial, get the app, which is free, and then this way you'll be able to follow along and go through it and see if you like it. And then we can also have Kevin Hoffman on. We'll talk about some of this Quanta, Fundotecna, and talk about screening in particular next week. Until then, I hope you have a great, great week, a profitable week. It will be volatile, I promise you that. And maybe it's just time to take a little bit of time off for the summer and not worry about it. Take off a few days and just kick back and just kind of watch it from a distance. And if you need any help, of course, with your portfolio, just give us a buzz over here. Check out the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. It's over on the Disciplined Investor in the show notes from this show. Just click it. It'll say virtual tour. Take a quick tour of it. I go through it visually and video and audio that you can see what's going on and how we do what we do and what we do and see if it's for you. Otherwise, I'll see you next week. Have a profitable one. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.